When I got out of MLM, I was overwhelmed by shame, regret, guilt, and loneliness. But sharing my story has helped free me up, and I want to invite you to do the same, either publicly or anonymously, as a catalyst for your healing. The From Huns to Humans podcast is a proud supporter of the hashtag I Got Out movement. Learn more and find resources at igotout.org.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey hon, it's me, Danielle. I am a licensed clinical mental health counselor, and I'm here to talk about all the ways multi-level marketing and mental health do not mix. It is important to know that this podcast is not meant to diagnose or for treatment. This podcast is based off of personal experiences and opinions, and is meant to educate and entertain. Now sit back and start healing with me on this episode of From Huns to Humans.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of From Huns to Humans. I am really excited today to collaborate with Lisa from I Got Out. If you've noticed, I have the bumper on the beginning of the episodes for this month. We are working with I Got Out to help share more stories, and I'm excited to hear part of Lisa's story and why I Got Out got started. So welcome, Lisa.
Hi, Danielle. Thanks for having me here. It's really great to be working with you this month.
Yeah.
Meeting you and the rest of the Huns.
Yes.
The Huns who are now human.
Yes. Definitely peeling out of that Hunbot shell and that automatic send everyone messages, always be positive. And now we're human. We have all emotions and we're allowed to, you know, keep our traumas to ourselves or share when we need to share them and not manipulate people by using our traumas. So all parts of shedding that Hunbot self, I guess.
Right. Yeah. That is definitely an overlap of MLMs, the Hunbot persona. I have my story that when we first started, I Got Out, within the first few weeks, I decided to share my story through video form. And I made a YouTube video. It's the first time I'd ever done any kind of video editing. But one of the things that, you know, in my writing the script for the video, I talked about shedding my cult persona, you know, shedding that I called it my cardboard cutout of what you put up in front of yourself to interact with, you know, the other people outside of the cult. And even to the people inside the cult, you know, I had a personality that wasn't mine. It's definitely the journey of finding your voice instead of reading from the script, whatever the script might be, if it's an MLM or a New Age cult like I was in.
Yeah. Is there any part of your cult story that you are willing to share with us today? and what that looked like, and maybe some of the similarities that you've heard about from, working with like me and Roberta and Michelle.
Yeah, so I got into my cult when I was 19. So, they say that adults don't really form their personalities, their actual autonomous selves until late 20s, early 30s. And I definitely, even while it was happening, when I was, becoming more and more attached to this group, I saw myself taking on the personality of the leader and reflecting what it was that he wanted the people that were in the group to be. And that's, for me, my group was very small, very insular. It started out a little bit bigger, and when I started going to this group, it was for classes, and then within 5 years, I moved into the cult leader's house. And then after I moved in, it was a progressive shrinking of the group to where, it was a 30-year journey. So certainly we had all kinds of phases that the group went through, but it's kind of interesting because it wasn't a hard sell. We didn't really try to sell it to anybody because once he had a core group of people that he felt he could work with, we would put on a show in the holidays and stuff and present this, look at how our lifestyle is so much better than what other people are doing. So there was that idea of a hard sell, but we weren't really trying to actively recruit people into the group. So that's a little bit of a difference, but I think with MLMs, multi-level marketing, commercial cults, there definitely is the idea that you want more people to join and be under you. And so that's a big difference between my personal experience. But in working with I Got Out, I've certainly been exposed to all kinds of different groups. And that's an aspect that I would say is fairly parallel in most of these organizations and religions.
Another thing that you had mentioned was your personality kind of solidifying in your mid-20s, working into your 30s. And that is absolutely something that I talk about with my clients and stuff, and like neurodevelopment and all of that stuff. But I think it's also really interesting too, because now a lot of multi-level marketing companies on our side of the on the multi-level marketing side of cult culture, are now targeting these really young teens, kids that are just getting out of college. And it's really scary, and it's really hard because, one of the things I brought up at the multi-level marketing conference that we had this year, was that we don't have any material to like educate kids. Like these kids are getting out of school and they're like going into college and they need money. And they're all getting targeted and losing money. And then also, I've also seen similar pathways of what you've described of people end up living at their uplines' houses and becoming like live-in nannies and things like that. I've had a couple of people on the show tell me that. And also what you said about like your personality becoming like your leader, I think that that's also very similar to what happens in multi-level marketing too, which is you become this like toxic positive person that your upline is, and they learned it from their upline, and like we're all just carbon copies of each other trying to make the world a better place.
Right. Well, boy, you opened up a bunch of different topics there. I could go in all kinds of directions. The idea of needing to educate our kids, really, it has to start really young of being able to live in the environment where demands are that they conform to fit in with their friends while supporting a healthy personality development. And what I see is so much, there's such a template for fitting in with religion. The people brought up in religions are made to fit a certain mold. It's a big question of how do we support children to grow up to be autonomous humans, able to recognize the red flags that come at us in all directions, primarily right now, social media. Oh my God, it's a beast. I see just kind of the capture of young minds, young bodies in these controlling environments.
And like, so I don't know if you've ever listened to the podcast Sounds Like a Cult that Amanda Montel and Issa Medina do. But I think that's what I was thinking about while you were talking is that, they talk about all of these like parts of our culture that can become culty. And I think that that is such a nuanced part of this conversation too, is that when we're talking about kids, like we need to talk about like the whole range of red flags of like some, like, so they did an episode on the cult of Taylor Swift. Like Taylor Swift is a pop star. Like, she's not, I mean, as far as I know, she's not like doing anything like that. But there are people that are extremely devoted to her. I'm definitely a Taylor Swift fan. I am very excited for her tour. But I think that there is like this whole range of people that absolutely in our culture, and I'm just using Taylor Swift as an example, there are the people that take it way too far and it becomes more and more cult-like as you get down that spectrum in our society of things, and social media kind of drives that because you can find these communities and then all of a sudden it becomes something that's not healthy and can be dangerous. And you can take something so innocent like music and it becomes something catastrophic.
Right. Yeah, it's there's a lot to cover there, and a lot of it's really personal for me too right now because of my I have my 13-year-old granddaughter living with me for this year, and so I'm seeing the influence of the social media, the attachment to certain images to reproduce that image. I mean, I'm looking at, my granddaughter's TikToks basically possessing her mind of how she wants to reflect into the world. And, at 13 years old, I mean, we're all trying to figure out who the hell we are. Right. I mean, that's any 13-year-old's reality. But now when you have, the marketing of products, images, all these things going into what kids digest, it's definitely an overlap with MLMs, multi-level marketing, and just the whole commercial consumerism beast that consumes all of us in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I kind of butted into your story a little bit with my commentary. So I don't know if you wanted to circle back to where you left off or if you want to go on
Yeah,
another
so
tangent
being
either way.
no, being young and being kind of sucked into a cult. So I guess the thing I would say is teaching. If I guess what I'm going to tell you is when I decided that I got out and needed to be, is when I realized that there really wasn't a platform or a resource that I would have been able to digest at 19 years old, or that I could find solace in as I was getting out. And that was the main driver for starting I Got Out for me, was that I would want to create the resource that in my mind I would have needed before I got into my cult in the first place. So then the question is, how do you make this information that's kind of overwhelming accessible to everyone, right? And it's the stories that do the work. It's the stories that a person can put themselves in each of these different scenarios to understand the mechanics of why people get into these, how it happens, because it's not a controlling situation when you get in.
Right.
It's the best thing in the world, right?
Yeah.
And
Absolutely. You don't
that's what
have.
it was for me as a 19-year-old. I came into this group of people and I was like, oh, they're all so much older than me. They have all these life skills that I don't have, and I'm going to learn all these great things to, be able to handle my life and do it better. And that's what I entered into as a 19-year-old. And then, it got really
Yeah.
bad.
Yeah, eventually something takes a turn, right? And I think that for the multi-level marketing community, the turn, I mean, there are so many, right? Like, 'cause I mean, we have just very basic stories of people just kind of like the classic financial being taken advantage of financially. And then, I mean, Roberta had some stories on Life After MLM last year that were really scary. Like, she had them during Halloween month, and that they were particularly scary, like involving stalking and like all of these, like, really harmful things that were products of the way we were taught to conduct ourselves, of being in an MLM, putting everything online and really having everything out there so people knew things about you and could like exploit you in ways that you could never imagine were going to happen when you're doing something so innocently as selling shampoo or whatever. But in
So the MLM, a multi-level marketing company, is asking its promoters or people that they're recruiting into it to basically share all,
Yes.
right? To be an open book of, this is what I do in the morning, and here's my morning routine, and look at this product and see how I use it, and I'm, in my towel or whatever. That's another culty parallel, because in most cults there is a kind of a through line of complete exposure. In my cult, we did a lot of I guess you would call it talk therapy, although the person running my group was not a trained professional. didn't have any therapeutic training, you know, but yet there's hot seat grilling that happens all the time. And, you know, especially after I moved in to his house, and you talked earlier about, you know, people moving in to be nannies and whatnot. I moved in and I was his maid for 25 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, the position got elevated to house manager, and, you know, I had more and more responsibilities. It was as we bought more properties, but I was basically the maid for the whole time. And, you know, you talk about labor trafficking inside of these groups. Well, that happens in cults too. And you give your service to the leader.
Right.
And, you know, and there's always kind of this carrot that's projected far off into the future of, you know, you do this work and you're going to reap this reward. You know, it's a little different for me because of his abusive nature. The carrots that were held was basically the reprieve from just his obnoxious personality. He might be nice for a few minutes if you please him. Right. And it's crazy, you know, and upon leaving to really realize this cycle that I was stuck in, you know, in this whole scene, you don't really see what it is until you leave.
Right.
The right. Toxicity, you know, that's always the biggest question. Well, if you're so abused, why didn't you leave?
Right.
And there's some interesting work that Alexandra Stein has done about, she calls it disorganized attachment. And that is when when the trauma or the abuse is being delivered by the same person who then consoles you or makes you feel better, it causes like this really major cognitive dissonance and an attachment bond. And I had that.
Yeah.
I had that pretty bad.
Yeah, that is definitely something I see more in my professional life, for sure. And it's very hard to work through. And I agree, it's way easier to see all of the red flags when you take a step back, because when you're standing in it, it's not red flags, it's a red blanket. Like, you're like,
this, well, and it's great. Just what you have to get through.
Right.
And yeah. I mean, for me, it was always, you know, an idea of. So in the new age philosophies that were promoted in the 80s or the 90s, there is a big thing about the diminishment of ego and how, you know, and I think this is a carryover from religion, you know, Abrahamic religions or whatever religions, that you give yourself up for God, you're a vessel for God, right? So you're giving away yourself so that you can be more of, you know, whatever religious thing you want to put on there. In my group, you know, it was spirit, it was, you know, evolving the soul, you know, but this idea that the more that you relinquish your self with a lowercase s, the more you can be, you know, selfless or more, you know, service minded. And I think it's a bunch of fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, now that I take a step back, I see how that's used to leverage, you know, work, work out of people or idolization, you know, to get somebody to do, it's coercive. It's a coercive control mechanism. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I'm wondering, is you mentioned that there were some like carrots, the positive things. I'm wondering, you know, what the rose colored glasses, I guess, were telling you was good. And also a little bit about how, you kind of go from, and you can either use your personal experience or maybe what you've learned from I Got Out of, like, how do you go from, you know, being a 19-year-old to being all in? Like mm-hmm. where is that line? And, you know, is there any like clear step that kind of people can look for that you notice in either in your experience professionally or right. personally?
Right. That's a huge question, because there is a shift from when you're being courted to, you know, they call it the love bombing stage or whatever, when you're being asked to, check something out or you're on the fringe. You're on the outside. You're not on the inside yet, right? So what's the transition that gets you from the outside to the inside? And I think, you know, one thing that I think people do a lot is, you're so special. You have a special calling. You're the, you know, it's karma, you're the chosen, you know, you're part of, you fit with us and we're doing this great thing. You know, I can tell you a little story about, I guess one of the first times that I was like, it's so fucking corny. So I had gone to the classes. I'd been at the classes for probably 6 months. 6 months, a year. And these classes were like, we did, the first class I ever went to was breath work. It was a rebirthing class. And then the guy also offered, and we'll get into this. This is actually a really good topic. It was, prosperity classes, but he also had relationship classes and nutrition classes. And he also taught body work. And so at any rate, I had been going to some classes, and when I met him, I was actually really, kind of freaking out, because I had a new baby. I was, you know, the mother of a 1-year-old, and, trying to figure out what the hell I was going to do with myself at 19. So I had a vulnerability just in that situation, and I just needed some answers. Needed some direction, some help, whatever. But he invited me out to dinner. And first of all, I'm 19 years old. This guy's 37.
Yep. That's a lot.
That's a big, wide, you know, it already is a imbalance. Yeah. Just in that. So he took me out for sushi for the first time I'd ever had sushi. And this was before sushi was a big thing. This was like 1986, 87. Took me out for sushi, and we're, you know, that's the nicest place I had ever been. And we're sitting there, I'm having some sake, I'm having my first sushi experience, you know, the moon was full, it was this like really kind of, and he had this charisma, this energy about him that made me feel, you know, all tingly and stuff, and the attention. It's, so I'm taking this all in, and, you know, at 19 years old, I had had a baby and, you know, my body didn't take it so well, like some moms can just pop out a baby and it doesn't affect their bodies at all. It affected mine. And I don't know how he, we hadn't like been intimate at this point, right? But he had this thing where he said, maybe I had been complaining about it or I said something about it, whatever. But at dinner, he said that we had been, that before in a previous lifetime, I had been a Roman princess. And he knew this because he knew me from that lifetime. Okay. And that because of how cruel I was in a former life, that's why now I'm having to learn humility in this life by having had, you know, wow, my body impacted and stuff. And, you know, that it's ridiculous to think about this now, but at 19 years old and being told by this man that everybody had, you know, placed, you know, was irreverent about, to tell me that we had lived in a past life together, that he knew me and that I was, you know, royalty and this whatever, you know, and I had been interested in this kind of like the whole idea of past lives, yeah, and spirituality, and you know, so I had been exploring that on my own before I met him, these ideas, and so I took it, you know, I was like, okay, that makes sense.
Yep.
And you know, from that little interchange and experience, and then being invited to become his maid, that I could take more classes and work off, you know, the cost of the classes by doing this service for him. You know, that was an easy transition. Like, of course, I had a cleaning business. I had started a cleaning business. So it wasn't like, perfect, you know, a foreign thing. It was something that I was already doing for work. And so that was, now I am now in his intimate space. I'm being allowed into, you know, his bedroom and bathroom and, you know, intimate spaces. So it was, you're seeing this transition of just being an interested person on the fringe, right? And now I'm being invited in.
Yep.
And, you know, I cleaned his house for a few years before moving into his house. And then we had the idea, you know, well, you know, my daughter needs a stable place to live. And our group was kind of, I guess at the time it was still, there was still a lot of classes, but by the time we moved in, it was starting to kind of consolidate to less people. And yeah, at that point it was more, we were shifting from being a center that offered New Age classes to more of a, what we would call an intentional family, or, you know, at this point. And that's another thing, is that there was also the idea that, and this is another strange overlap with like other cults, religious cults, is that my quote unquote teacher would take stuff from, you know, the Bible or whatever, like, and I never studied the Bible. I don't know anything really. I wasn't exposed to that as a kid, but this idea that you turn daughters against mothers and fathers against, or sons against fathers. Have you heard that?
No, I haven't.
Scripture. Well, it's a thing that I think it's from the Bible, but I hear this a lot about these family relationships being replaced mm-hmm. by the group. And I think even like in LuLaRoe, I seem to remember that Deanna liked to be called Mama, right?
Yep. Yeah, in multi-level marketing, you're whoever it like gets you in, your upline is your, so like when I was in Arbonne, it was my Arbonne mama, and then the person above her was my Arbonne grandmama, and then my great grandma, and it, you know, you have your sidelines, which are your sideline sisters.
Yeah, so that the replacement of family connections is yeah, it's a real deal, and it breaks, it broke my family apart. You know, it's already there was the space for it to be broken because of where I was at in life. You know, at 19 years old, nobody wants to hang out with their family, right?
Right.
So, you know, there was the room for that, but it didn't have to stay that way.
Right.
And that is, in fact, what happened. And even in the group, you know, raising my daughter in the group, our familial bond was also severed. So, you know, my daughter became just another one of the people in the group rather than, you know, having a familial bond and responsibility and connection with her. It's so weird.
That's really interesting to hear that. I mean, that sounds kind of like what I know about Scientology too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. It was that sort of idea that, you know, that we're old souls, and my daughter's an old soul in a young body, and she has the same level of intelligence and understanding. She just is younger. Right. And, you know, we just got through doing a focus of the month on the children of God for October. And you have people go back and look at some of the stories, and they're actually all uploaded now onto the website too. That was kind of a tenet of that religion as well, is this idea that kids are just small adults, and, you know, that's a whole different topic. I don't know if I want to venture into that.
Yeah.
It was a very intense month for me. You know, some really bad things happened to kids that were raised in that cult.
Yeah.
And it touched a sore place for me because of stuff that happened inside of my group. So anybody that's listening to this conversation, if you do go into the stories on I Got Out, depending on when you actually listen to it, there's a section of stories that are very, very intense. So most of them that are particularly intense have trigger warnings. But the content, the range, and this was a question that we talked about like before this conversation, Danielle, about like the range of experience that can happen inside a coercive or a controlling group.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I will tell you that working with you guys on MLMs after having the month of intensity that we had with October, I was like, oh, thank God. What a breath of relief. But the thing about it is that the worst cult is the one that you're in.
Right.
It's, you know, and there is really no comparing of tragedies.
Right.
Right.
There's no, you know, the loss that you're feeling with, you know, being taken for a ride with an MLM and all the money invested and all the energy you put into doing this thing that was going to change your life that turned out to be a crock of shit. You know?
Yeah.
It's as devastating of an experience as, you know, I don't know if I would say sexual abuse because that's really intense. That's a huge, huge trauma. And I know, you know, but I would say it's a real disservice to hold, you know, one trauma or one experience against another and compare it and say, I don't have a reason to speak out or tell my story or talk about what happened to me because it's not as bad as what happened to this other person.
Right.
You know, why am I whining? Why am I complaining?
Right.
And, you know, the fact of the matter is the same dynamics that got me into a 30-year foray in a high control group is the same dynamics that got somebody else into an MLM, that got somebody else into a political cult or, you know, in a rabbit hole or whatever. It's like that there's, and that's also one of the reasons why with I Got Out, we actually, besides doing the focuses of the month, we don't name specific people or groups in the stories that we allow our platform to be used for.
Yeah.
You know, because when you look at, and this happened kind of early on, kind of organically, we did a focus of the month on the Unification Church, the Moonies. And you know, we put out a bunch of stories that we got from different survivors, mostly second generation adults from that group. And one of the things that happened because we didn't say besides in the hashtags, who the group, what the group was, is we had people from other high control groups identify the things that were happening to them in their situation and then learn that it was the Moonies.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, because of the crazy visuals of the mass weddings and some of the prop, you know, some of the publicity that the Moonies had gotten, people identify the Unification Church as a cult. But whereas, you know, somebody in, you know, some church somewhere in middle America doesn't think they're in a cult, but yet the same things are happening inside that system.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's been really interesting. And I think that it's been interesting. I mean, throughout our whole conversation today, I've been able to pull the things that you're talking about and say, well, like, that's a parallel, and this is a parallel, and this is a parallel. And it's really like holding up a mirror, right? And being like, whoa, that's me.
Right. And that goes back to, you know, child education. You know, what do we need to do if the opportunity to have your life force siphoned into somebody else's agenda exists in all these different spheres, how do we prepare people to not fall in, right?
Yeah.
And I think this conversation and all of these conversations that are, I mean, I'm immersed in it, so I think they're happening everywhere.
right.
But I think that they're happening more now than ever before.
Right. Yeah. Well, cults are now trending, you know, the LuLaRoe documentaries that are out now, I think were mainstream enough that people have started to get into that rabbit hole. And then you start with the LuLaRoe documentary and then you move to the Vow and then you move to the Scientology documentary. And then, you start going down this documentary hole and you learn more and more and more. And you're like, oh my God, they're all the same. You start with this seemingly innocent legging company. And then you end up down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I think was really effective about the first season of The Vow is how, and that was my watching that show was the seed that started I Got Out in Me.
Really?
Was the fall of 2020, watching that show, seeing, you know, basically that whole, you know, Nexium in a lot of ways had so many parallels to my group. It was kind of the same shtick. It was slightly different because mine was so small, but in the very beginning of my group, I think that, you know, the dude that led it kind of had the same sort of vision. We talked about, you know, us all becoming teachers and being able to spread what it was that we were doing into different cities, and we'd have different houses and people could, or centers, and people could come and take classes from us. And anyways, that was like the carrot, one of the carrots that was early on. And of course that all dissolved as he got weirder. Or more self-serving, I should say. But yeah, watching The Vow, that documentary, I think, really opened the conversation for a lot of people because of how relatable it was. And yeah, like, you know, Mark's line, it's infamous now, nobody joins a cult, they join a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and I also think the political cycle is bringing a lot of this to the forefront. You know, I'm seeing more and more people understanding authoritarianism and what the repercussions of that kind of system of governance. You know, when we look at what's happening in our own political system, we look at, I mean, have you been following any of the stuff that's happened in Iran?
Is that with the hijabs?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, that's authoritarianism taken to its extreme.
Absolutely.
Right. So when you look at that kind of the system of control, power over, to the point where, you know, somebody gets killed for wearing a hijab wrong, that's nuts. But that's where this kind of stuff can go to if it's left unchecked, right? When people are put into power and have, you know, ultimate authority over a lot of people. And that's, yeah. So it's freedom. I mean, what's the line I have on the website? Freedom of thought is a universal human right. Like, we should be able to choose how we think, what we, you know, it's about combating the systems that place limits on a person's autonomy. And, you know, I get that that's done to make society work. We all have to follow certain rules to live together.
Mm-hmm.
But there's that, and then there's the use of people to support a person in power.
Right. I have two questions. I'll ask them one at a time. so you can answer them both.
Yeah, ask them slow. This isn't easy for me.
You're doing great.
Okay.
So one question, we're going all the way back to when you said you were already looking into like past live type stuff. I was wondering if that was something that was kind of breadcrumb to you in the classes and then you explored more. Like, did you kind of like go to the classes because you were already looking into this stuff, or did you see the classes and say, oh, let me try this, and then you kind of got breadcrumbed in?
Yeah, no. So I was raised, born in 66 and raised with two young hippies. My mom was 18, my dad was 19 when they had me. So, and this was, you know, as the whole machine of the counterculture was spinning up. And, you know, my dad got into a lot of, you know, different ways of thinking about things and spirituality. You know, he was trying to get free from his own controlling parenthood. So, you know, I was a flower child. I was a hippie girl. So I was exposed to a lot of stuff through my dad. And even, you know, my first culty experience was actually, you know, six or so, five, my dad was into Guru Maharaji, which was one of the gurus that was popular in the 70s, in the early 70s. So the idea of past lives was already sort of introduced there. I hung out with the Hare Krishna lady across the street. So I got exposed to the whole, you know, the Bhagavad Gita and, you know, chanting. And I used to chant my Hare Krishna chant, passing the Doberman pincher on the way to school to get me safely to the other side. Yeah, so I had been exposed to a lot of spiritual systems early on.
Okay. So
alternative.
Because what I was thinking about was how we know that there are other groups, you know, I'm thinking of like a very strong right wing political group that we know uses a lot of, you know, they take one thing that, you know, most people would say is true, you don't need to necessarily look it up, and then you end up being like, oh, well, this must be true, and this must be true, and this must be true. And it sounded kind of like that was what was happening with you. It's like, you already had this core of knowledge of, you know, that lifestyle that you were brought up in. And then this kind of fell in line, and then it just expanded and expanded and expanded. And there was no, I mean, for this topic in general, there really isn't an authority to go to and be like, ah, this is true, right? Like, it's all kind of based in theory.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. I had an exposure to alternative, and I say alternative, but I mean, in some cultures, Hindu religion is not the alternative, right? But in the United States, this was all stuff that was being imported to us.
Right.
Basically started with, I think, the Beatles bringing in the Maharishi, and it became trendy. And then, you know, people are latching on to something that's different from what they got raised in. But there's this kind of amalgam of spirituality and religion that's happening in the 70s in the counterculture. We saw that also with the Children of God, only they went to Jesus instead of Buddha or Hindu stuff. But you know, these belief systems, you entertain these ideas, and I will tell you, for me personally, I had, through my own drug experiences, psychedelic experiences, you know, I had the idea that, there was a creator, that there was some kind of beautiful thread that bound all of life. I had these spiritual experiences that made me think, you know, one of the things that I think happens or that is promoted in New Age philosophy is, you know, we're spiritual beings having a human experience, not human beings having a spiritual experience, right? So, you know, I had that kind of understanding and, or had that sense that was my lived experience from my own explorations. And because I already believed that, then the idea that having a spiritual teacher that would guide me to release my ego would make me more spiritual. Mm-hmm. But that construct of, well, I'm going to release my ego and be of service, and do all, you know, do all these things that are potentially demeaning or, you know, not reaching for something that's a higher value. Like, I didn't go to college because I was in a cult. So, you know, I was in this cycle of being of service to the cult rather than doing something that would eventually build my ability to live a productive, healthy adult life. Right. So by believing one thing and then taking on something else, my husband likes to say A plus B equals D. You know, just because one thing means is true and then something that's got a little bit of a thread of truth in it, you know, so you can kind of believe that, it takes you, each time you make that jump from one thing that you know is true or that you feel is true, and then you go down and keep believing the little threads of something, you finally wind up in some territory that's like truly off course.
Right. So I think that for most things, you know, so we kind of talked about how you start out because something's really good, right? And then, you know, you just kind of are along for the ride for a while, right? Until you finally wake up and realize that you're in a bad situation. But so, like, have you noticed any, like, I don't know even how to word this question, or even if it is a question to be answered necessarily, but what I guess I'm trying to talk about is, I'm going to use Nexium as an example because I think it's really applicable to the multi-level marketing space, because Nexium was a multi-level marketing company that turned into something so much more. And it's such a good example of how this commercial cult can turn into something bigger and bigger and bigger and more dangerous. I guess I'm wondering, like, where is that line? And, like, you know, like, maybe this is a question, maybe I need to try to get Sarah Edmondson on here, but, you know, like, where is that line? Like, when did it become something dangerous?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That is a great question, and one that I have wondered a lot. The life cycle of the cult.
Right.
When does the idea that started the organization or the group, when does it turn into something destructive? And, you know, we're not two-dimensional people.
Right.
Anybody that starts a group that decides, you know, I'm a leader and I have something to offer and I've got this great idea, I've got a better way to do things, and I'm going to help everybody because I have this vision. Yeah.
Right.
I think most cult leaders start out that way. You
Right.
know, have this idea that they have, you know, something that other people don't have that will really benefit people. And there might be an altruistic idea. I'm going to help people. I'm going to save the world. I'm going to offer this entirely different way to live. And, you know, it's going to solve so many problems.
Right.
And then more in, you know, so people are attracted to that buzz, that idea, that, you know, they attach to the concept. And when people attach to those concepts, then the leader is supported, you know, and this is specifically to groups that have a person at the top. They attach to the concept and support the leader in that concept. And the leader of that organization or group gets that hit. It's the same kind of dopamine hit somebody gets when they're building their social media platforms and are getting more and more followers. You know, I've experienced it myself, just the feeling of it in building I Got Out as we get more and more people involved and you know, people are really resonating with the concept of hashtag I Got Out. You know, you get this sense of, you know, I'm really doing something great. And when a leader takes the idea that it's them and not the concept, you know, then you start the cookie monster, the nom nom nom, and they want to take all that energy in for themselves. And then the negative aspects of that person, in my view, get empowered. And I think when somebody that has a certain type of personality gets that empowerment, they then become addicted to that cycle of being fed.
Yes. That makes a lot of sense to me. I think that you said it really well, that, you know, and I think that's why in MLM, people keep, you know, I said before, they refer to it as like, you know, like kind of a cult. They're like, it's a cult, but not like a cult. And people will say things like that and downgrade their experiences. And I think it's because there are so many leaders in MLM. So there's no, and MLM is so vast too. Like, you know, is it the CEO of the company or is it the boss babe next door, you know, or driving the Cadillac or whatever. And so there are so many people that could be considered the head that it makes it very confusing. And I think that's one of the pieces that makes people not think that MLMs are a commercial cult.
Well, you get to see how, you know, I think Sarah and Nippy talk a lot about the flying monkeys, you know, the people that are supporting the head, the group, and becoming carbon copies. Like I talked about early on, taking on the personality, you know, and I didn't have the kind of personality that would become like a cult leader, like the leader of my group. But I took on his ideas, and I took on certainly the concept of what he thought I should be, who I should be. But I think you're going to talk about, I mean, this is such an interesting thing with MLMs and, you know, having the personality. Because there's something that, you know, for myself, I find really repulsive about MLM shtick.
Yeah.
Because of the push of the cult of personality. It's like that you have to act the certain way to get the money and to so you're being fit into this mold of, you know, how you need to have your hair done and your nails and the whatever, the presentation to be able to sell this product. And it's very cookie cutter, right?
Right. Absolutely.
So I've always found, you know, all the Instagram influencer and, you know, boss babe stuff really obnoxious. And maybe that's just because I don't have that personality. I could never pull it off. That's a losing battle.
That's what saves so many people, is that, like, I could never do what you do. And, you know, and people, and the, you know, the boss babes are like, yes, you can, anyone can. And it's the people that are like, no, I really can't, that, mm-hmm. you know, get saved from having to go through that at all. So I wanted to pivot you to, how did you get out? And how did I Got Out get started?
Right. Well, in the 30 years I was there, I had, you know, a lot of push-pull, a lot of cracks. Or, you know, I think Yanya talks about, Yanya Lawlich, she's a cult expert, and fortunately now a really amazing colleague that is associated. She's a collaborator for I Got Out. She talks about the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all these, like, things that happen that get set on the shelf, and eventually the shelf will break.
Right.
And I actually just finished writing, I'm working on my book, on my memoir, but I just finished writing a piece about probably one of the biggest cracks that happened for me. That's a long story.
Yeah.
But the point, I'll have to say, you know, without going into that story, I think it was the tension between wanting to be a creative person and having all this stuff inside of me that I wanted to make, that I wanted to create, that I wanted to bring into form, out of my mind and into form. And it was in a lot of different areas over the course of many years, and having that effort or that desire to create stifled.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went through so many phases. My job in my group was to support creativity. But if I tried to do anything on my own, you know, that was my own thing, it just wasn't allowed. I wasn't given space to do that. And if I did do that, it was on the sneak. And if I, you know, let it out of the bag that I was doing something, the effort would get squashed. And there was a certain point when I had been working on creating something with my now husband that I realized that I would never be able to create this thing if I stayed. You know, that there were things inside of me that I would never, you know, at 50 years old, I would never have the opportunity to see come forward out of me, to really test who, what I'm made of, what I can actually do with myself. And yeah, it was, I guess it was that realization that really hit home. And, you know, there was all kinds of conversations and instances, and that's for the book. But, you know, you realize that living, if you live inside of a controlling system, you never get to find out what you're made of.
Right.
You're projecting your power onto somebody else and saying, you can do the good thing. You know, you're the one who has the voice that can speak up, that can make the world better or whatever. And I'll just have to support your mission. And, you know, the power really rests in the individual. If you give it away, you'll never find out what you're made of.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know.
So how did I got out start? Was
yes.
that the next one?
Yes. That was the next one.
But what were you going to say? I don't want to cut you
I
off.
I was just going to say, it just sounds like, you know, maybe when you're all done with your book, you might need to come back and, you know, tell us about your book so that people will go and read it. And
yeah.
we can hear more of your story. We might just need to have you back.
Well, and I've got to get all that stuff out of me. I saw something. I'll have to pull it up. Something that one of the authors that we featured in October said that was, let me just see if I can find it super quick, because it was priceless. It was like, yes.
I can only imagine how cathartic it must be to write a memoir about your experience. Is your memoir like including your cult experience?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
It must be cathartic to write like through all of that, but also to see that your life is more than that.
Well, and that's that, yeah, you know, when you ask that question, is it about the cult? One of the things that I realized very early on in starting the project is that I didn't want to give the cult so much real estate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is, you know, still the majority of my life. I'm 56. And, you know, I was in for 30 years. So it's still, you know, it's a lot.
Yeah.
But it's also not the whole thing.
Right.
And that's also one of the things that I got out is really about is supporting people to tell their stories, right? So, writing a memoir is just another long story.
Yeah.
We're working on some really fun stuff. We'll have to talk about that. But yes. I want to read this.
Yes.
Many people have a book in them, but it takes a special kind of freak to leave the land of laziness, cross the plains of procrastination and insecurity mountain. Find the blade of no one made you do this and use it to cut your chest open and yank that book out.
Wow. Yeah. That is intense.
Yeah. Well, and if you read Daniela, this is from Daniela Mestinyak Young, her book Uncultured, I just finished it, and it is stunning. It's an incredible book. And one of the interesting things about her story and the way that she told it is she was raised in the Children of God, got out and joined the military. And so she is comparing her experience with the Children of God and that cult type environment to the military and how culty that environment is.
Oh, yeah.
So when you look at the parallels of cults to MLMs, well, you can look at cults to the military, cults to the, you know, so it's, I think we're really right now in the process of redefining the word cult.
I agree.
A lot of people are using cult in, now we're talking about like Amanda Montel cultish or culty. It's on the spectrum.
Right. I definitely agree that there's a spectrum, and this, I think that it kind of goes from, you know, like, as they say on Amanda Montel's show, like a live your life cult to get the fuck out cult. I do right. like that spectrum that they have. I'll live your life, watch your back, get the fuck out. I think that that's such a good way to capture talking about these groups, because, you know, and like everything can be measured on like that scale for different reasons too. Like,
but here's the thing. Mm-hmm. The watch your back cult might have been my cult 5 years in.
Right.
The get the fuck out cult was the one I was in at year, you know, 2025, or actually probably closer to year 10. But, you know, it's yeah. when we talked about how, you know, what's the switch,
mm-hmm.
is that watch your back cult could just be the get the fuck out cult early on.
Right.
It's like that cult's now being led by somebody who is in the cycle of having that ego aggrandizement thing happen to them, where, you know, now their narcissism is being empowered, and they're going to start seeing how they can leverage all of this attention for their own gain.
Right.
And so I don't see it as a static thing.
Right. No, I think you're right. I think you're totally right. Because, I mean, any of these things, right? So, I mean, let's just say LuLaRoe. We'll just take LuLaRoe. And it started out as, you know, a basic legging company. Actually, I think it started out as maxi skirts. So,
which I still have one. I have one.
I still have a pair of the black leggings. But, you know, like it starts out as something so simple and so basic and so innocent, you know, seeming, and then, you know, whatever the motivation switch is, and in MLM, I think the pretty obvious motivation switch is money. And I think in more classic, I guess, cult groups, it could be, like power, or, you know, just kind of having, I guess this is power, but like kind of having control over a lot of people and having a lot of people look up to you, that like ego stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there, it could be sex, it could be money, it could be power. It could be really anything that people want.
Right.
That just right. changes, like if you get hungry for it, it's going to change your motivation, and it's going to change the way you see yourself in the group and the motivation behind
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell us about how I got out started.
So you talk about sex being a motivator. You know, I definitely think, you know, we were known in some places, in some circles, as a sex cult, you know, people on the outside. So as I'm watching The Vow and seeing how that story was unfolding, and I think at episode 5, the whole incident, you know, the whole ordeal of the branding stuff happened, you know, came out, and they were talking about the branding. And at that point, I was just like, you know, I'm watching my whole, you know, I was in my position in the group eventually was that of like Keith Raniere's inner circle of yeah. being a quote unquote sex slave. And at that point, when that episode dropped, I did a Google search for sadism in cults. I've got a note of exactly what my Google search was, but I came up with this paper, this Elsevier academic paper talking about coercive, like this situation with this cult leader in Jerusalem. And anyways, at any rate, the paper talked about the court case of the guy actually being held accountable because of the fact that the people that were in his cult, the women in his cult, could not consent to, you know, that they, his claim, of course, was that the sex was consensual, and the court determined that it wasn't consensual because of the coercive control in the group. And that was a light bulb moment for me when I realized that there's, you know, here we've got Keith Raniere being held accountable for his crimes in that cult. Here's another cult leader being held accountable, albeit in Jerusalem. That there was room for justice. You know, that we're starting to get to a point in our society when we're saying that's not consensual, that that things that happen, you know, in these controlling environments, women mostly being made to do things in an effort to please or serve or whatever. So that was a light bulb moment for me. I reached out to Sarah Edmondson when that light bulb went off. And, you know, she was in the middle of actually watching The Vow in real time. I don't know, that was kind of an interesting thing when I found that out, is they hadn't had a chance, none of the people had had a chance to preview The Vow as it was, you know, before it came out. They were watching it in real time as it came out. So it's an interesting fact, just because, you know, the same revelations or things, you know, everybody was seeing this content for the first time all in unison. And so I think that added to the power of The Vow. And it also added to certainly Sarah's receptivity of all these people that were reaching out to her, you know, trying to like kind of come to grips with what they were seeing.
Yeah.
So she was getting a lot of messages of support and stuff. And I was right in there with them all. And she was very, gracious in how she was responding to all these people, myself included, which just kept me thinking more about what survivors need. You know, what is it? What would I have needed when I was 19? What would, you know, at the time I was kind of cut off from my daughter, which was another factor of why I was looking at what would she need if she ever wanted to reckon with her cultic upbringing. So there's all these things that were happening at the same time with The Vow. And this was also leading up to the election cycle, the 2020 election cycle. And I had wanted to ask Sarah, you know, I had been following Steve Hassan and of course had read his book and the Combating Cult Mind Control, which is awesome. And also Yarna Lalich's book, Take Back Your Life. Highly recommend those for anybody that's processing through this information or reckoning with their potentially culty situation that they're dealing with. Those two books. At any rate, I had been thinking I wanted to ask Sarah for an introduction to Steve, and I had, before that, bought the domain igotout.org and had a vision for the nonprofit that I was going to build. So I was already playing with all these ideas, and I had all this, you know, vision of what people would need. And I saw Steve Hassan on Twitter use the hashtag I got out. So I was like, huh. So I called his office and asked him, you know, told his secretary everything that I thought I wanted to do with igotout.org, and which also did include a hashtag movement. And his secretary asked me to write that all down on an email and send it to me, because he's actually meeting with a couple people in just a couple hours to talk about this idea of a hashtag movement. I was like, cool. So I wrote down the whole thing, sent it off to him, and was invited to that very meeting. And that is when I met Steve, Mark Laxer, and Jarette Bullion. So that was the first time that I met her. And within a few, you know, that meeting, then the next meeting was the next day. And we came up with the whole idea that we would launch in tandem with the sentencing of Keith Raniere. And I brought Sarah into the next meeting. And within 5 days, we had the first website up, and it was a launch.
Wow. I think that that's one of the things that's really, really cool about the anti-cult space, is that there are so many people willing to collaborate with people, and we do it for the greater good, right? You know what I mean? It's all about helping people and moving forward and seeing what we can do to help each other. And it's honestly just so cool and so beautiful. Because I think in so many ways, most of us in culty spaces are looking for community, or stayed because of the community or whatever. And being a part of the creator community in the anti-MLM / anti-cult space has just been so cool. Like when Michelle introduced me to you guys, I was like, wait, what? Like,
right.
They want to talk to me.
That's, and you're exactly right about the collaborative, that, you know, the collaboration that exists today in the cult space is actually quite different than how it has been. And I will say that's turned the corner. You know, and I obviously wasn't in the cult space before 2020 in terms of cult recovery. But from what I've been able to observe, I don't think that it's been like that before 2020. There were a lot of cult experts and academics and, you know, what do you call them? The I can't think of the term, but when somebody goes and gets somebody out, at any rate, you know, they're no, I can't think of the word. It's okay.
All right.
But I think that it was, or has been previously, pretty competitive. Especially in academia, there's like the whole religion apologists versus the cult people. Like there's people that go, well, religion, you know, that's just a or what's that phrase? A cult is just a religion that hasn't grown, hasn't matured.
Yeah.
So this idea that, you know, we should allow these belief systems to happen. So I think there's been a lot of friction in this space.
Yeah, I can also see that.
And I think what's happened just with this new sort of visibility and awareness is that people that are speaking out now are much more willing to explore the territory in a more collaborative way. And that's also you know, when we started hashtag I got out, the hashtag itself was what we were rallying behind. You know, that was the reason for creating the website in the first place, was not to promote the web. The hashtag wasn't to promote the website or, you know, this loose collection of people that were involved in the project. It was to support and define what this hashtag was supposed to mean. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the hashtag came about because of how everybody's stories usually start out. You know, when somebody talks about a coercive experience that they were involved in, it usually starts with, I got out of XYZ, or, you know, this or that because of whatever. But that's the beginning of the story, is I got out. And with I Got Out, the goal has been from the very beginning to have I Got Out be the unifier between all of these coercive experiences that people are in, because the dynamics are all the same, right? So we're not talking, you know, when you talk about getting out of one thing, well, if you don't learn the dynamics of what got you there in the first place and how you get sucked in, then it's very likely that you'll be able, or you will be victim to another. Because like you said, we are looking for that community.
Right.
We're social creatures. We want connection.
Yeah. I also think that there is definitely still competition in the community. You're right. I try to stay blind to it, but I do know it exists. But I think that there are definitely people here too that are saying this is going to be way more successful if we work together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the more that we can band together, and, you know, even if some of the thoughts or beliefs or structures around things are a little bit different, if we can hear each other and make space for each other, we're going to help so many more people. And that's the bottom line, right?
That is the bottom line. That is. And, you know, for I Got Out, you know, this was kind of an interesting thing at the very beginning. I wasn't in a place where I felt like I could be visible. I was anonymous for the last, you know, almost 2 years. I've only since, I don't know, last summer, this, you know, a few months ago, started showing my face. And the idea with I Got Out as a platform was that we could provide a space for people to share their stories that weren't ready to be visible yet, but did want to, you know, say what happened to them in an effort to help other people either reckon with what happened to them or to prevent the next, you know, person from being harmed by a cultic group. So one of the things that was built into I Got Out was offering the platform for people who wanted to be anonymous. And I think that's been, you know, it's been a really important part of I Got Out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there is so much power in having the anonymous story and having the anonymous groups. I think that there is so much to that. Like I said, it's so much easier to get that mirror effect from people. Mm-hmm. And it's just so cool and amazing what you guys are doing. And I think this is a really great segue to tell everyone that if you're listening, there is still time for you to submit your, you know, MLM cult story to I Got Out. And we're going to be collaborating and reading some of those on me and Roberta's podcast at the end of the month is the plan. So,
super.
Yeah. So I think that will be amazing. And then what do you guys do with the stories that are submitted?
Yeah, so we have different buttons all over the place on the website, igotout.org, that leads to a form, and people can add their, you know, Word document of their story. They can make their own slides for, you know, social media, or just submit some pictures that they think look good with the story. But basically, people can choose where they want their story to live. If they want it on just social media, we put it up on our Instagram page. There's also a link on the link tree on our bio that's a share your story link. It goes to the same Google form to upload your story. And then they go on the website. If you choose to, they can be on the website or they can just be on social media. Yeah.
Yeah. So many exciting things. And is there anything that we should look forward to in the future from I Got Out? Like, what should people expect from you? Anything different than we've already said? I don't know. We didn't plan that question.
Well, no, it's great. So I Got Out has basically been volunteer driven, mostly with my work and Jarrett's work, with support of other people and of course others sending their stories. But we're at a phase right now where I think we're ready to take the next step into moving towards nonprofithood. We just signed with a fiscal sponsor, so we can take donations now. We're working out a way to be able to do that easily and quickly online with online payment. Right now, you have to write a check to our fiscal sponsor. But we're in this journey of moving towards having our own nonprofit and looking at raising funds for the work that I think the community wants and expects from I Got Out to happen. It's now grown after 2 years to be more than what two people can do.
Yeah.
So we're looking at hiring people to do some of this work, you know, making stories, all the administrative stuff. You know, there's just no end in sight for cult stories and the need for people to hear them.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's so much that we'd like to see happen. So, yeah, we're looking for volunteers. We're looking for money. We've got all kinds of big ideas.
So before I ask you my final question, they can find, it's just igotout.org, right? Like they don't, it's not any, right. And then I Got Out on Instagram, anywhere else they can find you?
So our handle on Instagram and Twitter is igotout_org.
Okay.
We have a YouTube channel. I haven't been able to put much attention to it at all. There is some great content on there now though. But not near as much. That's another wing of I Got Out that I really want to build, is telling stories through visual form. You know, the place that we focus the most has really been on Instagram.
Yeah.
But there's so much learning. Like I don't know how to do audiograms yet. I don't know how to do, you know, the story clips. I can't do it all.
Right. It's a lot of learning.
And that's one of the most wonderful things really for me that has happened with I Got Out, is it's a channel for me to learn. Even, you know, having these kinds of conversations that, I mean, seriously awkward for me, you know, because I lived for 30 years of living just a script.
Right.
I mean, I had a position in my group where I was a supporter. I didn't really talk and get to form up these ideas. That was his job. He was the mouthpiece. And so, you know, the whole concept of being able to articulate my experience, the concepts that are I got out, it's all new territory and it's awkward. And I don't know that it would be that way so much for people that got out of MLMs because it's such a salesy thing, but maybe it is.
Well, one of the things that we didn't really talk about is all of the guilt and shame and like embarrassment that we have over here. I mean, I'm sure you guys have your own flavor of that too, but there's a lot of that in this space for us, because when we get out, we have to recognize that we tried to recruit everyone in our lives that we loved or love.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's the term that I've really come to embrace with that is moral injury.
I like and that. I haven't heard that before.
When you're in these culty groups or high control systems, our efforts are leveraged to do the thing, whatever the thing is in the group. And we become, by that effort, the abuser.
Yeah.
Right? You know, we do things, we sacrifice our autonomy, we do the sales pitch, we try to recruit these other people in. You know, there's all kinds of things that we do in these systems that once you leave and you get out and you reflect, it's like, I can't believe I fucking did that.
Yeah.
I can't believe I let that happen to someone I cared about.
Right.
I can't believe that I turned my back on somebody who loved me.
Right.
I can't, you know, so there's all these things that we have to wrestle with, not just our own pain
right.
of what happened to us, but what we did or allowed to happen to people that we cared about. And I think that right there is probably one of the hardest things for people to reckon with coming out of an abusive system, because, you know, it's really easy to go point the finger at somebody who did you wrong. But when you were the one who was doing wrong, you know, that's a bigger pill. And it requires a lot of understanding of how these systems work and compassion for who you were.
Yeah.
Just trying to do the best you could with what you were tasked with, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Are you ready for my last question?
Sure.
Okay, so normally I ask people what their anti-MLM why is, because in MLM we had to have a why, and it was always like, have a why that makes you cry because it makes it more believable and people are more drawn to you when you have a powerful why for why you're in MLM. So I guess I'm going to change it for you and say, what's your anti-cult why?
Like, why, what was my why for why I was in? Is that it?
No. So what is your why for why you're doing what you're doing now?
Oh, what empowers my activism?
Yes.
Well, I will say it has changed. You know, from the very beginning when I started, you know, and I said this a while ago, I wanted to create the resource that I would have needed as, you know, a young person trying to figure out, you know, where, how to manage life, right? I think this information, all the stuff with the red flags and all that, is needed for all people, but why do I do it now? And I will say one of the things that's a really, it's a thought provoking question. I can take my time with this one, right?
Yes.
I don't have a pat answer. You know, I get the why all the time. Like when I hear somebody's story and am able to amplify that story through our platforms and have that person feel so validated by being seen and acknowledged, you know, that's a huge why.
Yeah.
Because I know what that feels like. And that's one of the reasons why it was really important for me to make our platforms accessible to people who did need to be anonymous, because, you know, they could write their story and it would have nowhere to go, or maybe they would put it out on, you know, bare their soul on their own platform, and, you know, the content would potentially be seen by people that are still in or don't agree with them or don't get any acknowledgement at all. You know, so it was really important for me especially, but I think all of us, to create that space for people to be seen. Nothing hurts more than to bare your soul and have nobody give a shit.
Yep.
You know, and I think that one of the things that we've been able to do with I Got Out is have people be able to be seen a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more as we grow this community and do these cross-pollinizations of different types of groups. So, you know, that's one thing. You know, when I started it, I had been not speaking to my daughter for several months, and it was actually probably over almost a year before, you know, and we've only been doing it for two, so it was almost a year before I started talking with my daughter, and that I told her what I was doing. And for me, one of the biggest whys was that I wanted to make it right for her.
Right.
You know, you talk about the moral injury, and, you know, things happened. You know, bringing a kid up in a cult is, I don't recommend it. Bad
yeah.
things happen. And I felt the need to atone for that. And, you know, I had originally wanted her to find I Got Out on her own and have it be the platform, the content, the material that helped her navigate her own experience. And I blew the whistle, you know, didn't blow the whistle, but I let the cat out of the bag and told her what I had been doing. And it actually, you know, in the time that we were not talking to the time when I told her about I Got Out and the months after that, it's been, I'd say, a huge bridge of healing between us.
Yeah.
You know, that my work and the fact that I'm dedicating, you know, at least right now, a lot of my time and effort to helping other people has atoned. You know, our relationship is mending. And, you know, it's that's a huge journey for me in this.
Yeah. You know, that reminds me of the phrase, you know, you go to therapy because of people that don't go to therapy. And like the people that are in therapy because of the people that don't go to therapy are looking for, you know, their parents to do the work. And what you did is such a gift, for your daughter to see that you were doing the work and you were growing and trying to heal. And I think that's so powerful and so moving. And I'm so glad that you guys have been able to repair over the work that you've done. Like, that's amazing and beautiful.
I couldn't live my life without it.
Yeah.
It wouldn't, you know, some things you just can't, you can't go on with. You have to face it. You have to deal with it. And, you know, even if that hadn't happened, my thinking was, well, if it doesn't mend for us, it'll help somebody else.
Yeah,
But
absolutely. Well, thank you
yeah,
so
fortunately,
much.
it happened and it worked and it's
Yeah.
working. And, you know, she's proud of me and what I've created, and I'm proud of her and what she's doing with her life, and things are really good.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Lisa, for sharing and just, I think this is an amazing conversation, and I think it's so valuable. And again, like you are welcome back anytime. And I just think that these conversations are so welcome and so needed. So thank you a million for being here today. And yeah.
Thanks for being such a good interviewer. I'm glad, if anybody makes it to the end of this, I think the end was better than the
You know, sometimes you gotta get the jitters out.
Oh,
Yeah.
the awkwardness.
Yeah. But all right, everyone. I hope that you have a fabulous weekend and go check out igotout.org and their Instagram because you're gonna find so many powerful stories there. And feel free to submit your own because your voice needs to be heard too, especially if you're not wanting to come on the podcast. I mean, the door is always open, but if you're one of those people that are like, not me, not me, I Got Out might be the perfect place for you to share your story. So yeah, I hope you all have a great weekend and bye. Hey, huns, I just wanted to take a second to tell you guys about Acorn. And no, this is not a sponsored ad. Acorn is a robo investing account that I've been using to manage my money since I've started my own small business. I honestly had no idea what I was doing in regards to saving for the future, but knew I needed to start somewhere and thought this was a great way to get the ball rolling. I really like the interactive graphics and watching what's going on with my money. If this is something that you feel interested in, feel free to click the link in my bio to start your own Acorn account, and we'll both get $5 added in our accounts for our investing future. Happy savings!